Well, let me first thank the organizers for inviting me to this remarkable program, where I learned that resurgence is omnipresent, and in particular in the integrability in gauge and string theories, about which later Ignes and Daniele will speak about, well, will say some words, because the subject is so vast that I will try to give some introduction to it, but certainly I will fail. But let me try. The main example about the integrability in gauge and string theory is the maximally supersymmetric Young Mills in the planar limit in four dimensions. Planar means the number of colors going to infinity, and we are in the Toft limit with some Toft coupling constant, g squared is equal to the original g and Mills square times the number of colors. This theory has the observables in this theory are finite. So all observables are expanded in integer powers of the coupling constant. This is a theory which is conformally invariant.
So you implies that you are not considering, you know, non-trivial moduli.
Non-trivial moduli.
Yeah. Vacuum average.
No, they. No, because it's conformal. They are forbidden by the conformal.
No, it would be spontaneously broken, so yeah. Conformal ones, right?
No. Coulomb phase. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. The other symmetry the theory has is the flavor 06 symmetry, which is the symmetry of the scalar fields, and also there are Chetri supersymmetries. And all this is packed in the symmetry group, which is PSU(2,2,4). let's call it G, this group. Because of the two, principal and the special requirement, we have six charges, which are the two conformal spins, the dimension, which is a function of the coupling constant, and the three spins of the R symmetry.
But six, you mentioned it is this kind of flavor group, or it is a part of this.
So
because you have this SU4 kind of flavor, right? So.
SU4, yes. SU4 or
but SO6. SU4 it's not, okay, but 6 is the level, right? I mean, it's not.
The scalar fields transform according to the anti-symmetric representation of the
SU4, yeah,
and which has a 6
right dimension. No, so you can say that it was 6, okay.
Yes.
But it is still part of a PSU or this?
yes, this is. Oh, everything is part of PSU. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I can say that, well, the group element of this group is has such a structure. So you have the boson quantities. This O24 here, O6 here, and here you have fermionic generators, the forcing matrix. The fact that the dilatation operator has eigenvalue which depends on the coupling constant means that this symmetry is actually centrally extended. Otherwise, we would have only the three level. Here. it is known before the integrability of this theory was observed that it was conjectured long ago and now it's beyond reasonable doubt that this symmetry is dual, this theory is dual to a string theory in a curved background with the same symmetry. So this is 2B superstring on which target space which is anti de Sitter, five-dimensional anti de Sitter space times five-dimensional sphere. So this the symmetry of this space is this one, the conformal group. And the symmetry of S5 is O6. So this is kind of hyperbolic. And this is sphere. And this has a negative curvature. This has positive. So the total curvature is zero, which guarantees that the theory is conformal invariant. here, the perturbative expansion in the string theory is in 1 over.
But you say total curvature is 0, you can. The scalar curvature, or, you know, what?
The Gaussian curvature.
Sorry?
The Gaussian curvature.
I see.
Yes.
So, no, Gaussian means that it is a Ricci or it is a scalar curvature?
Scalar. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, the effects. Of negative curvature we see which would bring to a mass term will are exactly cancelled by the effects here from the sphere. So the theory here is expanded in 1 over g. This is the perturbative expansion of the string theory. And this expansion, while this expansion is finite, this expansion is asymptotic. And Ignes will give an example of a quantity, cusp anomaly dimension, with such asymptotic, which is whose expansion in 1 over g is asymptotic, and you will observe a trans-series in. in it. So, about 2002, I mean, this is Malthasena, who formulated this correspondence, but the ideas about that were already in the air, and I would say Sasha Polyakov.
I think it was 97.
Yes. Maybe 97, I...
It's exactly 20 years less than that.
Yes. Sasha Polyakov contributed a lot, but the final formulation is by Malthasena. Five years later, became this brilliant idea by Minahan and Zarembo. To apply the two-dimensional integrability to this four-dimensional gauge theory. So the idea of Minahan and Zarembo is that if we consider trace operators of the fundamental fields of the theory, I should have said what are the fundamental fields here. So we have so this theory is obtained by taking n equal to 1 supersymmetric gauge theory in 10 dimensions and dimensionally reducing it to 4 dimensions. So you will have four gauge fields, and the remaining 6 gauge fields will become scalars. Six scalars, and also you have the fermions. So you can take any product of fields like the covariant derivatives, scalars, fermions, etc. And this will give the all in the same point of the Minkowski space, and this will give a basis for all possible gauge invariant local operators. Let us, to illustrate the idea of Minahan and Zarembo, let us take the simplest non-trivial subset of operators, which is by the field Z of X, which is phi 1 plus I phi 2, and another combination X, which is phi 3 plus I phi 4. And consider all the local operators made out of these two fields. So they are the form trace of z to some power, z, 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 then x, then z, and x, and all possible words made out of two letters.
But it is 4 out of 6, right, field?
There are two more, yes. But I consider the simplest possible subsector. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are, of course, there are 6 possible combinations. And now we can imagine that this operator is something like discretized string made of string bits, which are put one after another. And the fact that we have trace of matrix fields mean that we cannot commute them. Their order is fixed.
Is there a reason why you pick it to be holomorphic, the chain?
Yes, there is a reason. And the reason is that the propagator between between two Zs is zero. There is no interaction between the fields in the chain. this is a combination that conserves the charges.
And there is no propagated between Z and X as well, right?
Or no propagated between Z and X. So we can say that these are string bits, or in some more familiar language for the physicists who did solid state physics, spin chain. So you can say this is a state in a spin chain with of the Heisenberg ferromagnetic, where the up spins are the Z fields and the down spins are the X.
But it is kind of chiral link in a sense that it is all these fields are the same chirality or here. So I mean the perturbative, for example, it will be zero.
Perturbative?
Yeah.
No,
if all propagators are...
Between them, they are zero. But if I take the propagator between, if I take the two-point function of this field and another field which is made by Z bar,
okay, but then it's propagator of O and O bar, right? Not propagator between...
Of course, yes. So we can imagine that the X field is... then this state is obtained by reversing part of the arrows, part of the spins. That is, we started with the vacuum, the ferromagnetic vacuum, which has just z, 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 and then we put, excited this vacuum by reversing spins. So you can say that this is a product of operators, which excites this vacuum state. Which corresponds to the vacuum state corresponds to the BPS field, BPS state, which is protected by the supersymmetry. So the excitations are we have to sum over all positions of these insertions with some momentum, and these are the magnons in the spin chain. So the operator creating a magnon with some momentum is equal to the sum over k from 1 to the length of the chain, exponents of I p times k, and one reverse spin at the kth place. The correspondence with the spin chain is the following. The dilatation operator in the gauge theory, at one loop, this is the simplest possible case. G goes to zero, only one loop, and SU2 sector. So dilatation operator, in one loop, we have the eigenvalue of D. Of the D is delta 1, where delta of G is the dimension, which is L, the classical dimension, plus G square delta 1, plus G to the 4 delta 2, etc. So this, the first coefficient, is captured by the XXX Hamiltonian, which is just the sum over the sides of the spin chain of the Pauli matrices
but in field theory, in original field theory, it's not a commutonian, it is dilatation, right? So it's a different operator,
yes.
Right, than the commutonian.
In the field theory, this is completely different. Right? It acts in the Hilbert space.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here, in our string bit interpretation, we have this Hamiltonian. So how it acts? So we have in our original theory, we have this commutator terms of the five fields, which means that we have four vertices in the theory, and we have string bits that are exchanged because of this interaction. And this exchange is described by this XXX Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian...
But in field theory dilatation, you know how it acts on the field, right? If you just apply dilatation there, right?
Yes.
It would be not an exchange, right? In field theory, it would be application of dilatation to those fields, right?
The correspondence is not so trivial. So you have to do some work. You have to compute some Feynman diagrams and to see that effectively the effect of this computing Feynman diagrams with these vertices
I'm kind of confused because dilatation, how X dilatation, in original on original field, you are changing X and you're multiplying maybe field by certain factors, right? Okay, that's it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and it's not an interchange of the field in original formulation, right? Certainly not in the change. When you are saying that it is, when you are saying that it corresponds to the spin model, it's okay. But you are trying to say more. You are saying that exchange. In sigma correspond to exchange of field, and this
there is mixing of operators upon the loop.
Yeah.
So the dilatation operator mixes operators, and you want the eigenvalues.
I see. So it's after kind of diagonalization of one loop.
Exactly.
I see.
You want really the anomalous dimensions, which are the eigenvalues of this.
Okay, but in the lowest order anomalous dimension trivial, right?
It's trivial, of course.
Yeah. So there is exchange.
Thank you, Daniele. I got the question. Indeed, the dimension in the first order is completely trivial.
Yeah.
So if we exchange the fields, we don't gain anything.
Yeah.
But if you add this Hamiltonian, the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian will add some energy to the spin chain, which will generate this this non-anomalous dimension. And so the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian operator or the spin Hamiltonian are combinations of such fields. And these are described by magnons, which are with different momenta, and the momenta should be chosen in a very particular way, which correspond to the beta ansatz equations explained yesterday by Patrick. The problem of finding the anomalous dimensions of Super Young-Mills theory boils down to the problem of diagonalizing the spin chain Hamiltonian. Well, unfortunately, for finite G, the Hamiltonian is way more complicated, and it's even non-local, because the one loop of Hamiltonian describes the interaction between the nearest neighbors, the two-loop Hamiltonian between next to nearest neighbors, and so on. But we don't need the Hamiltonian, actually. We need something which is more useful than the Hamiltonian, the transfer matrix, which was fortunately defined yesterday by Patrick. So if you know an infinite set of transfer matrices labeled by their spectral parameters, we are done. You have infinitely many conserved quantities and can hope that the theory is integrable. So if you consider the general excitations around this Z vacuum, they have a symmetry which is less than the original symmetry of the theory, because we here fixed one direction in this target space. And residual theory, the residual symmetry is PSU 2 slash 2 times the same PSU 2 slash 2. So I label them by left and right. So the excitations can be, say, described by some operators which contain two indices, left and right. And effectively, they decomposed into left and right parts. And each of them scatters with the left parts, left with the left, right with the right. So the scattering matrix of this theory of this has such a form. So it's a product of the left left with left and right right with right. So this is SL times S.
But there is no object with one index, right? I mean, it is just when you are writing that it factorizes, you are not implying that there is magnon with just.
No.
Like left one, or no. They are vector like.
No, but we know that that in spin chains, there are sometimes the excitations are decomposed into simpler. Entities. For example, the fermions can be considered as product of spinon and.
Yeah, but the question could be that maybe you have something like solitons which are would be with one index, and then you this factorization would be that you made your chi out of two solitons, one with eight, another with eight dot. That's why I'm asking.
Maybe I don't.
You see, when you have this, say, take side Gordon, right? You start from the, this, and then you have kind of fermionic solitons, if you like. So, I mean, because you can view your original Bessel field as a combination of soliton and solitons of, you know, which you have in this theory, and it is with also the Molochko mathematics, right there.
If you can propose such a construction, certainly this would be very interesting.
No, I mean inside what you know of it, right? No, that's why. No, I mean just I'm asking just by analogy.
But in some sense, this left and right components in the correlation functions. I don't know if I will have the time to do that, mm-hmm. but they will start to carry their own life, mm-hmm. and well, but let me go until there. So I want to prepare a little bit the Daniele's exposé. I will introduce the non-trivial part of the scattering matrix. Mm-hmm. So these two parts are completely determined by the symmetry, by the supersymmetry. But there is another part, which is the diagonal part, which is non-trivial. And it is determined by the crossing symmetry, which is very non-trivial in this case. So the crossing symmetry means that if you have a particle composed states of a particle and antiparticle, you have some charge conjugation matrix here, and we scatter it with fundamental excitation, then the result will be. I mean, just the product of the two two fields, the product of the two scatterings is one. So this is the the crossing condition, and this means a quadratic equation for S with the second factor, the momentum and the energy with opposite sign.
As kind of that kind of analog of the no particle production, like say that you have a matrix which does not produce power. If you do be in the channel of, you would say that there is no, say, two particles goes to four.
No, this is the crossing sign.
Yeah, I see. It's crossing because
no particle production.
Yeah.
I would say is the Young-Baxter.
Yeah.
If you have several particles,
okay,
then you can write them as a result of the scattering of 2 by 2.
Uh-huh.
And of course, you can do it in the opposite way. And this is the basis of all integrability of the model. Yes? Yes, of course, we have that. And this will be heavily used. Mm-hmm. I will not use it, but. So, also, you have the unitarity, which means that S of P prime is equal to 1 over S of P prime. P. Now, important thing is that we have to define to derive the.
P prime P, it is a set of.
It's changed the two parts. Yes, yes. Yes. The magnons in this spin chain have a momentum and energy. Energy E and momentum P. And there is a dispersion relation between the momentum and the energy, which is very peculiar here. So it's is given by E squared is equal to 1 plus 4 G squared times sine squared of P divided by 2. So if we take the weak coupling limit, this is the dispersion relation of the Heisenberg spin chain. But if we take the strong coupling limit, then and also P small, we obtain the relativistic dispersion relation for some two-dimensional relativistic theory. So this relativistic theory is nothing but the string theory sigma model. So,
but if you will take G equals 0, then E equal 1, right? And it corresponds to what? It's canonical dimension?
Yes, exactly. Yes. Usually this, one can parameterize this dispersion relation by the rapidity variable, U, which is in the G goes to zero limit in one loop is just P is equal to U plus I divided by 2, U minus I divided by 2. When G is finite, we cannot parameterize in such a simple way. We have to introduce one more function. And this is what Volody Kazakov baptized it Zhukovsky map. Let me define the function x of u is equal to u plus square root of U squared minus 4 G squared. And the inverse map is U is equal to G times X plus 1 over X. Also, let us define x plus or minus is equal to x of u plus minus I divided by 2. It's shifted. So with these definitions, the momentum and the energy are parameterized in this way. P of u is equal to x plus divided by x minus, which resembles the x case. And the energy is equal to x minus minus so we see that the momentum and the energy are not analytic in the rapidity plane. So they have, if this is the rapidity plane, u, they have two cuts. And these are the cuts of these functions, x plus and x minus. So this is something, in the beginning,
And this is like a cut, or what just like?
Yeah, cuts.
Cuts, yeah.
Yes. So if we take P of u, and if we continue it through the cuts, we will obtain, it will change, no, it will become some other function. Originally, people tried to introduce some global parameterization.
But in this way, it is still energy is you are writing effectively energy as function of u, not without u bar or what?
Energy is a function of u, and p is a function of u. Yes.
Yeah. So there's no u bar, right? If u is complex, right? So in this way, it is still holomorphic.
Yes, they're holomorphic, but
there
they
is
have
a cut.
Cuts. Yeah, two cuts. So this is a fact of life. You cannot repair that. We cannot invent holomorphic analytic parameterization of the momentum and the energy. And this is something people fought with. It was unusual, the feature. But finally, this is something that helps to solve the theory, because all the Bethe Ansatz equations, the TBA equations, which are infinite set of integral equations for this theory, they can be packed into a kind of Riemann-Hilbert problem for a Riemann surface of 8 sheets, which they call now quantum complex curve. And the sheets of this Riemann surface speak with each other through these cuts. So yeah, these cuts are very
useful. But why you call it non-analytic? It is still analytic, right?
Well, it's holomorphic, yes.
It's analytic, right? But
yes, holomorphic. So now let us define the crossing and mirror symmetry for this theory. So what is mirror symmetry? Mirror symmetry is when we change the time and the space change, and this is the basic condition to be able to use the TBA arguments to in order to compute the vacuum energy and the energy of the excited states for finite L. So this is the usual homological trick. So the theory is not relativistic, but we have this mirror symmetry that allows to go to a mirror theory in the opposite channel. So the The mirror symmetry is such that P goes to minus or plus to I energy in the mirror theory, and E goes to minus I P tilde in the mirror theory. And the crossing symmetry is when particles become antiparticles, that P going to minus P and E going to minus E. So how it's realized in this parametrization? It's obvious that mirror symmetry is when x plus going to 1 over x plus and x minus 1 over x minus. For the mirror symmetry, x plus goes to 1 over x plus, but the x minus goes to itself. So this can be realized in this way. We have two cuts. We go through the lower cut, and we return on the other next sheet here. And this effectively, this changes x to 1 over x here. And the crossing symmetry is that we go through both cuts and we return to another sheet. So this is, now they call it gamma, this 2 gamma. This. The crossing symmetry can be then very simply restated in terms of these transformations in the following way. This is a functional equation which was derived by Dima Volin in 2009, I guess. So the this non-trivial factor in the diagonal part of the scattering matrix, actually this is sigma square of uv. No? So sigma of uv is can be parametrized as sigma hat of u plus v plus sigma hat of u minus v minus divided by sigma hat of u plus v minus sigma hat of u minus v plus. So this.
I'm sorry, but when you're doing this mirror symmetry, for example, G stays the same or G also changes?
The same. For any G, we.
Okay, take G equals zero. I'm trying to check.
Then this is one.
Then what means is this, if E is zero, if G is zero, then E originally was just one. P and P doesn't depend on P. I am looking at your relation.
Yes, of course. But the
Okay. Now, what would be the mirror symmetry for this case?
The mirror symmetry needs finite G.
Perturbatively,
it's not defined.
I see.
So this is the benefit we have.
Only if because you cannot go also the cut. Right?
Yes, no cuts we cannot go through.
No, there is a point.
Yes. So perturbing, deforming the theory is sometimes beneficial.
Yeah. No, but it is almost like in Bible.
So this variable, this quantity, sigma of uev, and is simpler than sigma hat. It has only one cut on the real axis. And usually it is parametrized as exponents of minus I, some function chi of u and v. So the Volin's equation is the following. Sigma of x, y, sigma hat. Sigma hat of 1 over x, y. Sigma hat of x, 1 over y, n sigma hat of 1 over x, 1 over y is equal to gamma function of 1 minus I u minus v divided by gamma of 1 plus I u minus v. So the crossing equation is quadratic, but you can put it in a more symmetric form by making it a fourth order. And if you take the logarithm of this equation, you will see that this is just a Cauchy-Riemann problem. Oh, no, Cauchy-Riemann or Riemann-Hilbert? Riemann-Hilbert. So the sum of the logarithms of these things mean that this is the continuous part of log sigma when we pass through the cut. And similarly here. So we project, if you take the logarithm, we project to the continuous parts of this function at the logarithm of sigma bar, and we obtain this analytic function. But we know from people who worked with matrix models know how to do that. So this is so we just apply the inverse transformation, which inverts this projector. In well, inverse, it's not the right word, but we can relate the discontinuity of this function to the continuous parts by a certain kernel. And this is this gives directly the Dorey-Hoffman-Maldacena representation of the dressing factor log sigma of u v is equal to integral du x minus x of u integral on the unit circle or around the cut integral dv x minus x of v, and here you have log this gamma. Gamma of 1 minus I u minus v. And this is the function about which Daniele will speak in some minutes. So I was too ambitious. I wanted to speak about the three-point function and to derive the matrix model, which computes the asymptotic part of this function. But if I do that, I will not leave any time to Daniele and Ines. So I don't know. I will.
But it is. I mean, it has some kind of. It you cannot take this integral explicitly, or you can. I mean, thus is just
analytically. So the answer is just a function, one function which has a one cut, single cut. Yes, in any of the two variables. Uh-huh. Yes. But if you go through the cut, you will see a hell of other cuts, many, infinitely many cuts in both directions. And this is actually what you should see, because this scattering matrix must have double poles because of the bound states. And you will discover these double poles by going to the lower cut.
Okay. Can you expand it as function of G, for example, the answer?
The answer can be expanded in a function of G, and Daniele will tell you how. Okay, so I will stop here just for. David is here, and I started to explain the integrability of n equal to 4 super Yamils. So I remember I was visiting Sasha McDowell in Princeton in the 90s. And Sasha Midal wanted to solve the Monte Carlo QCD. So his final attempt was to take a product of covariant derivatives, d mu 1, d mu 2, etc., trace them, and then write kind of loop equations for this space of discrete quantities. And then David came and said, "But Sasha, these are just words." And yes, but finally, Sasha was in a sense right, because this is what this was the principle of the integrability observed by Minahan and Zarembo. You take all possible words, and we write some Hamiltonian that describes the. The
so,
of course, yes, yes. Sasha didn't. Right? No, he was all impatient, but also ambitious. He wanted to solve exactly right the QCD.
He still is.
So let me. So who will be the first, Daniele or Ines?
Shall I? Well, I just want to introduce this, because it only depends, you know, variable, and it's very simple. But I'll be very fast.
No, infinite. No, it goes to infinite because I over 2 meters p equals infinite, right? So you go to infinity. So it's kind of from different sides of infinity. So we just did not see this. It's still there.
So, after the introduction in integrability, what I wanted to tell you is just about one simple case where, of course, people have found, as Ivan mentioned, people had found that there is an asymptotics in strong coupling. I mean, the theories, the observable that I'm going to talk about is has a Taylor expansion for weak coupling, for small g, but for large coupling, what you have is definitely an asymptotic expansion, and there's non-perturbative phenomena associated to it, of course. And the first question that, of course, we had is, can we actually use tools of resurgence to analyze this strong coupling and even make, you know, the connection to the weak coupling results? So the very, very quickly, we're dealing with. Well, it's n equals 4 supreme wheels, you could have left. So we're talking about the anomalous dimension of Wilson loops. Sorry. So with some limited loops in n equals 4 supreme wheels. So what you assume is that you have a light-like cusp in integrated contour. You have an SL2 sector. You're assuming that you're in the SL2 sector of n equals 4. And you're taking the Lorentz spin. So you're basically putting a lot of... When you're doing this type of words, you're taking that the number of derivatives, which is basically given by the Lorentz spin, is very large. And you are taking also a few of these five fields as well, which they call like the twist. And what they find for so this is just a very brief thing. They find that this, the anomalous dimension is given by by something actually, give me just a second. If I take the spin very, very large, they find that something, they find something here that does not depend on the twist. So that it's basically a universal scaling function, which is the Kaspanomas dimension. In terms of the ADS-CFT correspondence, this actually can be calculated. So this function is exactly, can be calculated from the ADS-5 cross S-5 by basically taking, we're taking a large spin, so we're taking like the spin in ADS-3, so we're taking some spinning strings that actually don't live in full ADS-5 cross S-5, but they live in ADS-3 cross S-1. They have a very large spin. sorry. And you basically can calculate the G correction. So this, from the point of view of the N equals 4, you could do in N equals 4, you could do a small coupling, but from this point of view, what you're doing when you're analyzing large spinning strings, you're doing large coupling. And this, in particular, is the regime Benjamin Basso, actually meaning people before that, found that it was already asymptotic, but they really proved that there was non-perturbative.
Epsilon depends on G and what else? What the
second? Ah, sorry, J. So J, sorry. J is in fact L over L. I forgot. So they found that if I calculate the scaling function at strong coupling, it's asymptotic. In particular, because of the whole integrability that playing a role in ADS-5 cross S-5, you actually have a way of calculating this gamma function from an integral equation. So there's an integral equation that defines this gamma function. Sorry, and let me just check. I really want to. So, yeah. So let me just. So there's an integral equation that defines the Kaspanomas dimension, which basically, let me just. And this is valid for any coupling and comes from integrability. In fact, this is due to Beisert, Eden, Staudacher. So this is the function. This is a kernel that is basically a sum of a bunch of Bessel functions. In fact, this is going to be exactly what you hope to get with the 15 minutes time, but this is valid for any coupling. In particular, it has been solved numerically, of course, and you can see how it solved for each value of the coupling.
But so it does include epsilon as well, right? So it's not just gamma.
For this equation does not give you information about epsilon.
But how you differentiate between capital gamma and epsilon? You can shift to.
Epsilon specifically does depend on L.
Okay, let's take L much smaller than log of S.
This is a universal function, so it does not depend on L at all.
Okay, I agree. But then epsilon is defined up to the shift, right? Because
okay.
So you need some kind of boundary for epsilon as well.
Let me write that actually what I'm interested is only on this, okay? Mm-hmm. So in principle, you'd have the whole gamma, but I am saying that I'm only looking at this limit and this limit alone, and in this limit, this epsilon does not contribute. So I am really, really only looking at this particular case. So and that's the universal part. In fact, and I didn't have time, there's some work done by, I can see his face, in Bologna.
Oh,
Fioravanti. which actually he finds some universality in subleading contributions to this, and actually some maybe some asymptotics even in S, right, in log of S. So, but this part I don't quite understand the full thing. But in particular, in this case, I'm just looking at large coupling and this quantity. So what I wanted now, so this there are ways of solving this equation. Basically, there's a meaning. Basso and Konchemsky actually found a really good way of actually separating all these kernels into a coupled set of equations by doing just by changing a change of variables. That it's just something like this. This basically kind of decouples this integral equation into a set of coupled equations, which then they use the methods of, and honestly, I can never say their names, meaning that they've done this for the ON model for a Fourier analysis to actually solve the integral equation. And let me just, you know the names that I'm talking about, sorry. Hasenfratz and Niedermayer. I don't know if it's actually how it's said. Okay. So, and they used their methods basically to actually solve the couple set of equations. Well, I'm really not stating how specific, how you have to expand. In fact, in order to use, to find a trans series solution for a case like this, it's much trickier than for an ODE, because the ODE kind of gives you right away what type of, if you plug in the correct ansatz, let's put it this way, it usually kind of gives you a hint of what the non-perturbative phenomena are. Here, putting the because in fact, in the end, when you're solving for the trans series for the gamma, and you're plugging it into, like, not directly this integral equation, but this, what you obtain from Fourier analysis, you're in the end actually solving for the, you know that this gamma, this original gamma function, has very, meaning it's an entire function, it has particular, you expect that this omega has particular zeros and poles because of this co-th, and basically you are trying to solve the trans series by making sure that all the analytic properties are obeyed. In any case, one thing that you can easily do is actually generate the perturbative data. So this is meaning it, and you hope that by doing something like go to the Borel plane and analyze the singularities, you can actually find some information about the non-perturbative structure. And this is now how where resurgence comes to play. So if you actually do that, what you find for the perturbative series, so I'm assuming now that gamma of G is some gamma zero of G, which has a, I might be. So where these are my coefficients, there might be a factor of two here wrong at the moment, but I'm, in anyways, this is just a, so this is this. And I want to calculate all the gamma k's. And if I now do my Borel plane analysis, what I find is that I have some cut starting, at least. Let me say here it starts at A, and there's another one here starting at minus 4a. And a is so, actually, if I assume that my variable is actually what's showing up here, because I think this is actually, I think this is x over 2. If I'm analyze everything in terms of this variable for the Borel plane, because I'm just keeping the 4 pi included, a is just normalized to equals a half. So from this, you can already see the structure. Let me just... just quickly. You can already see a structure of trans-series showing up. So you, from here, you already expect a two-parameter trans-series, one much closer than the other one. And this is the first one. So you can actually continue doing this. You can actually include a trans-series, especially if you have some idea already of what type of trans-series you want to get. You can get a trans-series. It's going to be, of course, here at least two parameters. In fact, it's a multi-parameter trans-series. It has several. And it will have, you know, and you can, and by doing and generating more data, so you now do exponential of minus a of, sorry, minus a g times now some gamma of 1 of g, which is also a series, and et cetera, you can actually check that large order does relate all of these sectors. So it's a resurgent trans-series. You can calculate the large order relations and everything.
What is A?
A is from, okay. I guess it's a 4 pi or 8 pi A. No, it's, okay, there's the factors of 2. So two things that you can do with this is that actually you find that these exponentials are directly linked to the O6 model that is actually behind the whole, ADS5 process 5. And this is actually given by the square of the mass gap of the O6. That's one of the main things. The other thing is that from the resurgent structure, you can see that you have, for example, you're interested always, of course, in summations in positive real coupling, because the coupling is positive real. So you actually know from the resurgence how to exactly do summation in this region, for any which will give you any value of the coupling in principle, in order to actually not worry about. So this is called the medium summation, and you can actually obtain by doing a proper integration above and below. You can, well, you find the Stokes constants, etc., and you can actually find you can sum the trans series. Of course, the more terms, the better. And you can actually obtain the results for weak coupling that you can find directly from n equals 4. And
since we have linear torsion, the extra terms, the trans series, must satisfy the homogeneous integral equation.
The homogeneous?
Without the inhomogeneous term.
Without this inhomogeneous term?
Yes.
No. So it's an infinite set of linear equations.
It's an infinite set. So
connected.
They are connected, but they're meaning it's. In any case, meaning if we're really going to give 15 minutes for him to talk, I think this is a discussion for later. Sorry, I can't.
But what means definition is a limit? This small gamma, non-capital gamma, is it expandable in its argument or not? So can I expand gamma as function of GT?
So this is already the final result.
You write definition of capital gamma.
Yes.
I'm looking, you define it as a limit at t equals 0, right? Capital
of
gamma,
this,
yeah, this small one.
Gamma, yes.
This small gamma, non-capital gamma, is it expandable in GT or not?
In GT?
Yeah, no,
the small gamma, you can actually solve for GT. You have results for not just this solution, but the full gamma. Meaning this is not the analysis that I'm talking about, but you do have the coupled set of equations are coupled set of equations for gamma, which depends implicitly on G. So when I write here T,
So it's not function of only one argument.
No, sorry, it's actually function of
like
G and T. I know. I'm really sorry. All of this is actually okay. Depending always on G and T. It's just implicitly.
Yeah, because otherwise you see it kind of.
But in any case, this is just a brief thing that actually resurgence does play a role, a strong coupling for particular observables. It's not the only one, and hopefully, I took 15 minutes, so now.
Let me make a comment and then you can comment on my comment.
You don't need a mic on
there? No, don't worry. Okay.
You might want to tell the
Yeah, I'm going to keep that one, yeah. Okay. But I also wanted the Borel plane.
Okay,
thank
I'm
you.
Fading off.
Thanks. Thank you, Nash. First, I just want to make a small comment. So, okay, I'm going to be talking about actually the point that Arkady was making. So, from this guy in here, G is buried deep into all this function, right? It's in the cut and everything. So it's not really clear what kind of G expansion you're going to get, a strong coupling or weak coupling. But let me just comment. So bottom line, it actually turns out that the strong coupling expansion of the dressing phase. Sorry, yeah, so this is called the dressing factor, and chi is roughly called the dressing phase, combination of chi's of the dressing phase. It's asymptotic, and it can represent it with a trans-series, which is very similar to the trans-series that Inesh wrote. However, so you get that this dressing phase, I'm going to write it later on, but anyway, you have some perturbative coefficients. G to the minus n. So remember, we are doing, I think the G I'm using is 2 pi what you use. So let me put GI. Whatever. And this is the one that Inesh was actually using, I think. So you get a perturbative expansion in which these guys have, OK, some zeta function, but then they're asymptotically growing. And then you have non-perturbative physics, which goes like e to the minus 4 a g. Well, instead, let me rewrite what Inesh wrote. Gamma of g has some perturbative physics. And then she had e to the minus a g. All right? And I'm just going to make a comment in here. The Casimir for SON is m minus 2. And we are dealing with SO6, so Casimir for SO6 is 6 minus 2, 4. So this is somehow telling you that these guys here are more likely related to IR renormalons of the SO6 sigma model. Well, instead, these guys in here are more related to like uniton type of solutions. So there are, on the SO6 sigma model, there are some sort of like uniton. So they are unstable saddles.
They appear later in the world.
They do, of course, yeah. But in here, we don't find them. We don't find IR renormalons. We only find these guys. To be fair, in this connection, what Inesh was saying, so Aldai and Maldacena show that there is some IR effective description of the cusp anomaly in terms of the energy, the ground state energy of some SO6 sigma model, then you expect to have IR renormal type of contribution. And these are exactly the guys that you find in here. In this case, in here, it's just a comment that I'm making. We just noticed that they are 4 times as big, or as small, maybe. But there is no SO6 behind. Well, so I just wanted to make this comment because you were asking. So, OK, in 5 minutes, I'm just going to write how, well, no, we finish at 12, no?
10 minutes.
Oh, right. Oh, OK. Good. So let me keep that function over there. And the key point is exactly how do we get the strong coupling expansion for that one. So basically, from dressing phase, I'm going to just talk about this chi, x1, x2. So I'm just going to use, it's great that you introduced all this then, thank you. So X1 and X2 are the magnon charges written in terms of those variables for the two magnons with rapidities U1, U2. And then this guy can be expanded as a sum R equal to 2 infinity, sum S equal to R plus 1 infinity minus CRS of G, divided by R minus 1, S minus 1. 1 over x1 r minus 1 x2 s minus 1. So the whole dependency in G now is buried in here and also hidden in the magnon charges. But now there were serious efforts in trying to compute the first correction at strong coupling. So in here, I'm assuming G is much bigger than 1. And the leading contribution to the dressing phase was found by Gleb, Arutunov, Frolov, and Stadacher, I think. And it was really difficult. I mean, solving those equations is really hard, even a strong coupling. Then there was some subleading correction found by Hernández López. But then they came up with some sort of guess for an all-order expansion of these coefficients in here, which is what I'm going to write now. So this was just a guess, and it passed many checks. It's just g squared, sum n 0 infinity, some coefficients, g to the minus n minus 1, when g is much, much bigger than 1. So this was introduced by, it was guessed by Weisert, Hernández, López, I think. And then they had, so this you see is the perturbative part of a transseries. And actually the bottom line is we actually found that this guy has to be replaced by some transseries with some exponentially suppressed terms. However, they came after with some magic continuation. They said, oh, if you want the weak coupling expansion, just do the following. G, sum n equal to 0 infinity, the same coefficient evaluated at minus n. And then you just get g to the n. So this for g going to 0. So remember, g much, much bigger than 1 means strong coupling in Young-Mills, but means weak coupling from the string Borshid sigma model. This is the opposite. And this was some sort of magic analytic continuation, which they kind of did. I actually don't know historically if they deduced the magic kernel and then they deduced this relation or vice versa. But anyway, they introduced a kernel whose expansion of strong coupling was giving you this coefficient, and for which they show that if you compute this guy in here, you solve that equation over there order by order. However, the point that I want to make very quickly is that this coefficient in here, I'm going to be focusing on the strong coupling. And these coefficients in here are asymptotic. And the bottom line is that when you replace the perturbative expansion with this transseries expansion and you apply median resummation, this magic kernel is not a magic kernel anymore. It's really the Borelli-Carré summation of the strong coupling transseries. In particular, even if you expand a strong coupling, once you do this Borelli-Carré summation, you can extract also the weak coupling coefficients. So they're all there.
So if you put n minus 1 and g squared, it would be even more similar. Because you put g to the power n minus 1, and here the g squared. No, and there g squared.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're right. No, yes, you're right. So I just wrote it like this, just because if you take it in this way, perfect, Good. So, excellent. So, we started with these guys in here. I'm not even going to write them down. Take it from me that these guys go like theta of n, gamma of n plus 1. So, they're factorially growing. So, we just define some sort of modified Borel transform. We simply take this series and take each one of these coefficients and divide it by n factorial theta of n. T to the n. And this I'm going to call it the Borel transform, modified Borel transform. And then you simply apply the usual, so I take each coefficient and divide it, and then you get an analytic continuation, which is the following. Just get that if you take the analytic continuation of this guy in here, you just do the usual, let me go and see. So use all Laplace kernel, remove the factorial, since we also removed a, whatever. Since we also remove a zeta function, we have to use a different kernel. But that's just some technicality. It behaves very similarly to the Laplace transform that we have seen many, many times during these courses. The only thing is that in this way also remove a zeta function. And now you see that this function in here, as Ines was saying before, if I study in the Borel plane, the poles, now I do have actually a branch cut starting in here. And another branch cut starting here. So we applied this technology and we found this completion. One needs to add to the strong coupling expansion infinitely many non-perturbative corrections. So the proposal by Beisert, Hernandez, and Lopez is good, is the perturbative part. So let me write this by the Hernandez and Lopez. But then you need to add infinitely many non-perturbative corrections, which goes like this. Let's say A, 4AG. Times each one of them is multiplied by their own perturbative expansion. And then, of course, you know, at the beginning, these coefficients in here were found because you wanted to solve the equations that they were over there, this crossing equation. So of course, I cannot simply add other stuff because I was already solving those equations. However, the story gets a little bit subtle. So in here, you have to distinguish. There are two types of coefficients. The even one truncates, and you get the solution to the inhomogeneous crossing symmetry. So the crossing symmetry.
But here it is minus 4ak. Can you write the truncate there?
Sorry, thank you. Absolutely, yeah. So this guy in here was already solving the crossing symmetry equation. I'm adding something else. Better for me that if something else solves the homogeneous crossing symmetry. And actually it does. If you plug it back in here, you get some non-perturbative contributions to the dressing phase. And they go like e to the minus 4 pi g k times, I still want to get a function of the rapidities, you actually get something which is a rational function of x1, x2. We plug it in the crossing symmetry equation, and we get zero. So this is a solution. Actually, we can generate infinitely many solutions to crossing symmetry, which is a non-trivial task, because this crossing symmetry equation, they look absolutely non-trivial. These guys in here are there. And of course, we do know that they had to be there, because we assume that the best kernel was the correct one. And in fact, if I take this media
whether you answer the question right away or not, it's the two type. This generates the factors, but how do you know they're the minimal solution?
What do you mean, the minimal?
The homogeneous equation.
No.
Because they are. No, we know because of what you're going to say next that they are, because that's how you get the decoupling. But how would we know from the beginning whether they were a minimal solution or not?
What do you mean with minimal?
That with the minimum number of poles, it's like when you're trying to find the homogeneous.
I just resummed using media resummation these guys in here, and I got this extra stuff. In principle, if you want, you can add them. So you could add them like 10 times, instanton by instanton. This would still solve the homogeneous, and it would give you a different chi. However, the key point is that given for granted the Beisert, Hedenstad, Aachen kernel, this is the only one.
But imagine that I didn't know, like in other situations of ESCFT, how could I know what
excellent.
The minimal solution?
Good. Then, if you don't really know anything, then you don't. But if you know the weak coupling, these are the ones that give you the solution. Because now it's absolutely not obvious how to extract the weak coupling from the transseries, right? If I expand this guy for g going to 0, this is nonsense. This, remember, is an expansion in 1 over g, poles, infinitely many poles. However, if, this is the final thing I want to say, if mostly because it's connected to probably your work. So if I resum these transseries in here, it's actually fairly simple. You simply get that this guy, the summation, which I'm going to use with the same symbol, is the same sinh square kernel. That's not really important. The thing is that this guy in here was ill-defined because there is a branch cut. As always, I need to go like this or like that. But when you add all these infinitely many non-perturbative corrections, you just get the real part of this guy. And now this is well defined. Although it looks nothing like the kernel that Bison and Aden and Sadakhan found. For them, the kernel was something like this. I thought I wrote it. Yes, I did that. Good. For them, the kernel is something of this form. dt, some Bessel J function, r minus 1, 2gt. This is the Bessel that you were writing, part of the kernel. S minus 1, 2g over t, divided by, it's not really important, t, e to the t minus 1. And they call it magic kernel because it literally came out of nowhere. So if you expand this guy at weak coupling, that's very simple. You can plug in g small, and you get all these weak coupling coefficients from the Young-Mills point of view. From the strong coupling, it's really difficult to see that it generates these guys. And actually, it doesn't. It generates the full transseries. So this is what they were missing, but this is the correct one if you get these transseries. And the way to do it from the Borel plane is absolutely not obvious. So the way we did it is to somehow use some very particular properties of the particular Borel transform to map the problem using some sort of conformal transformation. But Gerald tells me that this should be more general than that. Because, of course, this now is a function on the complex G-plane. You got it at strong coupling, but it contains information also for the weak coupling. So in principle, you should be able to get the coefficients. But we have to use the explicit form for this guy to rewrite it. This is actually not a difficult function. It's just elliptic integral E, elliptical integral K. But you can rewrite them sending C to 1 over C, and you can close the contour, and we show that you get exactly the best kernel. So in this sense, they are minimal. If you give this guy, then you have the weak coupling. This is the only strong coupling that gives you that weak coupling. Add something new, you're going to get a different weak coupling. Good. Although, final point, we have absolutely no idea what these guys are. So first thing, unlike what Inesh told us about, the dressing phase is not really something that you would get from a proper path integral calculation. In principle, you could say, OK, I'm inserting some correlator, attaching LSZ, and computing the scattering matrix as some sort of correlators. In the Kasparov-Moss dimension, that is really the ground state, the mass gap of an underlying sigma model. We don't have something like this in here. So the comment that I made about the fact that these guys look more like instantons in Young-Mills versus IR and normals in Young-Mills is something that is kind of picturesque, but not proven.
But it could be this kind of serotonic type of... In terms of this magnon, it could be this solid.
Oh, I have absolutely no idea in terms of that. Yes.
No, I mean, it could be related to the same.
Yes. But you see, the procedure is completely different. You're not really studying that kind of problem. But yeah. Thank you.
Does it capture this?
That's a good question. The answer is, I don't know. Yeah, it should. I think it should, but we haven't checked that. It's very difficult to get the strong coupling from that one. Mm-hmm. I think the weak coupling was checked, right, that it reproduces the one from Beiser, Teden, and Staudacher. So yes, I would think that it does reproduce these guys, but they're somehow buried. Because as you were saying, as Arkady was saying, from that integral contour representation, it looks very non-trivial what's happening when you send a strong coupling to infinity. So the branch cut goes all the way to infinity, and I don't know what's happening. Yeah.
I think it has been checked.
Yeah, but it's not. And they checked all the proposed strong coupling coefficients, just the first few. For the weak coupling, I think they checked.
That's a good question.
Because this was really a proposal, right? They had just a few orders, and then they saw that you needed infinitely many order, just because. Just with the even coefficient? No, you do, yeah.
No, it has to. Okay, we can talk. Sorry.
This is a good point. So you need to have infinitely many terms of strong coupling, because if you have finitely many, then the weak coupling regime doesn't make any sense.
Of course.
You get like poles. But the inhomogeneous crossing, the crossing symmetry equation, can be solved with a finite number of terms, just the even terms. And then they say, oh, that's the end of the story, but then the weak coupling doesn't make any sense. Let me try to add some odd terms. And then they kind of came with this guess that you had to add infinitely many, and then this was the weak coupling. But from DHM, I don't know. I agree with you. They should be there. Yeah.
Another question. Is there a Stokes phenomenon here?
Oh, yeah. It's very simple. That's a great point. Yeah. So although we get infinitely many terms. Somehow these are fake in a certain sense. The zeta function, so let me write something trivial. The zeta function is containing infinitely many instantons, but they're all of the same type. So the Stokes phenomena is just a one parameter, not even one parameter, a two-term transseries. So you just get a jump in the instanton sector. The thing is that you do have a branch cut just because you have the zeta function. So let me write something very trivial. Zeta of n is the sum k1 infinity, 1 divided by k to the n. So you see that if your perturbative coefficients are going like this, then you would think with all this talk that you know you have a pole at 1, a pole at 2, a pole at 3, and they're all like all these instantons. However, they're not really different from one another. They're simply all coming from this function. So the Stokes phenomenon is very simple. If you just do s plus minus s minus of the perturbative, I think I wrote it down explicitly, you just get the same function, but repeated infinitely many times. You get the sum n equal to 1 infinity n g squared e to the minus this 4 times action n g. And then exactly the same non-perturbative terms evaluated simply at n g. So you see the function is just 1. Sorry, there are of course dependence on RIs. And then in here you have a plus or minus. Sorry, if I put it like this, you have just plus I over 2. You have just one Stokes constant, but infinitely many non-perturbative corrections. But they're all fake. They all come from just one correction, evaluated at g, 2g, 3g, just because you have this zeta function inside. Yeah. Yes, yes. Other questions? I understand that. I understand that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this is the last session of the
program,
so I would like to thank you again, organizer, for this marvelous conference.